Call the meeting to order, and I apologize for being a little late. I went to use that new hand dryer in the bathroom here, and it sucked me in, and I couldn't get out. There's so much force. So. Yeah, I know. Obviously, it's not a problem for you bigger folks. Anyway, let's see. We'll continue with amendments. I see that Mr. Rakowski's here today, and maybe what we'll do if one Representative Downey shows up is we will have Mr. Rakowski come and just give a few comments.
They're already okay with
Are they okay? Mr. Rakowski, just want to come up quickly while we get Representative Anderson's amendment passed out here. Yes, she is. So we'll have this amendment passed out. And while you were gone last night, we had an amendment, which I'm sure you're aware, on prevailing wage. And now that you've been able to see it, we hope you had a good time at the bar last night or wherever you were. But in any event, while you were gone, the cat's away, the mouse was playing, and we want to know what you think of the language that got put on. And I wish Representative Downey was here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. I think I should be wearing a button that says, "Where's Dolly?" this morning.
Yeah.
Instead of, "Where's Waldo?" The language that was in the amendment was agreed to actually, I want to say several weeks ago, Mr. Chairman. The interested parties had finally negotiated, if you will, among their own stakeholders. And the language that was the result of the amendment is language that we did agree to. Some of it was cleanup language from the prevailing wage enforcement legislation of 2 years ago. And as you know, at the end of the amendment, it describes willful and repeated violators of the law would be subject to an additional $1,000 fine, which is in keeping with the rest of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So if you're an employer who violates child labor law or minimum wage law willfully and repeatedly, you are now subject to the same penalties, or a prevailing wage. A contractor who's subject to prevailing wage would be under the same penalty provisions that are currently in the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we're pretty much then we got peace in the balance. So okay. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask this last night, and I didn't do it, but Representative Mahoney, I don't have the amendment in front of me, but there was some reference to under oath, and I'm wondering how that happens when you're doing a report. How are you submitting a report under oath?
Representative Mahoney, do you want Mr. Rakowski to answer?
As I remember the amendment, because I don't have it in front of me either, I think it's certified payroll records is what you're referring to, because I don't think it was any under oath, but maybe Mr. Rakowski might have a better answer than that.
Yeah, Representative, that's correct, Representative Nornis. It has to do with the issue of certified payroll. The subject came up after the 2007 law was enacted, was that the Department of Administration, which handles, as you can imagine, probably thousands of construction contracts on behalf of the state of Minnesota, had created electronic payroll notice, if you will, and this language simply strengthens that responsibility on the contractor to provide the right payroll.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Rakowski. Representative Anderson offers then the A27 amendment, and Representative Anderson, go ahead, but I thought we voted on this yesterday.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you did or not. I don't recall yet. I was stuck in two committees, as you remember. I had Environment Finance, and I had this committee going on simultaneously. Both with the omnibus budget bills, but you know, I saw this in the bill, and it was of great concern to me that we're basically increasing the tax on businesses. And I just like to get this addressed here on the committee level rather than on the House floor, and maybe we can save ourselves some time.
Well, Representative Anderson, we had a full discussion on this. We had presentation by deed. We kind of ironed out some misconceptions, I think, by the testifier from deed on the amount of money. We had, I believe, a roll call vote, if I'm not mistaken. So if you want to put us through the whole thing again, that's fine. But
if I could, Mr. Chair, better here than anywhere else, right?
Well, so...
and I would like a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson then offers the 827 amendment and would request a roll call vote. And members, we've heard the whole discussion on this yesterday. So Representative Anderson, one last, I guess, comment on the issue.
Well, just that, Mr. Chair, we're looking at a 40% increase, you know, for businesses at a time when they can least afford it. And if we're looking at creating jobs and generating job growth here in the state of Minnesota, this is not the way that you go about doing it. And so that's why I'm offering this amendment.
Members, I'm going to have someone from Deed come down on this so people understand what actual type of money we're talking about here. Over the biennium to a business, because it's only, this tax is only, I believe, on the first 28,000, 29,000 payroll, like a UI tax. Mr. Nelson, are you going to be the one to discuss this? Is Ms. Elsie around today?
No, she's not.
Oh, okay. welcome to the committee. And could, for the information for the committee, Mr. Nelson, tell us what currently a employer pays on an employee annually, and then what it will go up to under the proposal.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. Currently, an employer pays a tax fee on the first $26,000 of wages paid for an employee per year. Currently, if a worker is paid $26,000, the employer would pay $26 in the workforce development fee.
Annually, right?
Annually. On the first $26,000.
And so annually. This will go to at 0.14, then what would it increase from $26 a year to?
Well,
$36.40 is. Is that right? Because it's a 40% increase.
Yes, it would increase an additional just over $10. It would be $12, I believe. 10 or 12, I'm not good in my math in my head, right?
And
$12 a year. Mr. Chairman, that would be for the starting July 1st. Of course, no revenue would come in until October 30th because the tax is paid quarterly, and once the tax commences on October 1st, the first quarter then would be the one ending September 30th. The tax would be due October 30th. The first increase payments would be due from employers on October 30th of 2009.
Okay. And Representative Anderson, we had the discussion. The fund is completely depleted right now, according to testimony, other than an amount of money that has been set aside for large layoffs. From what I understand, we don't know what that amount is, but maybe if Representative Gunther wants his question answered, he can get the answer to that later. So.
Mr. Chair, I think it might be helpful to kind of put this in perspective of the kind of impact that it would have on businesses. And I don't know if anybody is here from the chamber.
The chamber talked on this last night.
Okay, well, when you're talking about, you know, going, what is it, you said $26 up to $34.60, and that's per employee?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it would increase just over $10 to $12 a worker. So it would go from $26 a worker up to about $36,
$38
a worker.
$36.40.
Well, when you have, you know, 100 employees, you know, that's a chunk of change, Representative Rukavina. And I know, Mr. Chair, you look at these issues quite a bit when you're talking about, you know, average Joe citizen. Well, some of these small businesses, they're just average Joe citizens trying to make a living here and support the employees that they have, and we're just adding an additional burden and making it more difficult for them to operate in the state of Minnesota, let alone keep the employees that they have on staff right now. We're just making, it's just one more chink in the armor that they have to keep going as far as being a business in this state. And I don't think that we're helping them any when we are passing things like this that makes it just even that more difficult.
Representative Gunther gave an impassioned speech about the good job that the workforce council does and how they get people back to work, and he supported this, so I'll remind your side of the aisle, Zach, and we did have about at least 20 minutes of testimony, if not more, on this last night. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I don't argue with the value of having this fund. I think that all employers would argue that there is value to having this fund. It's just a matter of how much can businesses afford at this point. We are in a dire straits when it comes to our economy. I don't think this is the right time.
Okay, heard the motion, roll call is requested. Clerk will take the roll, recommend a vote, no.
Anderson, aye. Acton, Bly,
no.
Reiner,
no.
Clark, Detmer,
aye.
Downey, Eastman, Gunther, Haas,
no.
Mahoney.
No.
McFarland.
Aye.
Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Norton.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Norton.
Yes.
Obermuller.
No.
Poppy.
No.
Reiner.
No.
Slocum.
No.
Welton.
Yes.
Eastman.
Yes.
The amendment does not prevail. Representative Mahoney. Mr. Sarah is in the audience. So, Mr. Sarah from the University of Minnesota wants to come down and discuss something that's in the bill regarding the university's research facilities. That were bonded for, I believe, last year. Welcome to the committee. Bienvenuti.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to comment. Specifically, it's on our Article 2, Sections 24 through 29, dismantle the university's biomedical research facilities program.
Mr. Chair, what page are we on the bill?
No, the page is Article 2, Sections 24 through 29.
Page is 29, members.
29.
Go ahead.
This building program was strongly supported by both houses of this legislature and the governor last year. For the following reasons. It would result in new ways to prevent and cure disease. It would result in the commercialization of new technologies, the generation of new business. It would generate $120 million of new federal money annually for research coming into the state. Over the next 4 years, it would generate 4,800 new jobs. It's already attracting new venture capital for investment in Minnesota in the technology that's coming out of the university and the University Mayo Partnership. And because it would retain Minnesota's position as a world leader in biotechnology, it's probably worth reviewing who the supporting organizations were. Life Science Alley, the BioBusiness Alliance, Minnesota High Tech Council, the Business Partnership, the Chamber of Commerce, the Mayo Clinic, the UMayo Partnership, all of the statewide economic development agencies in all portions of the state, community and consumer groups. At this point, I'll give you an update as to where we are. We are ready to move into construction for the first project, which leaves the other three. A question was raised about how about what we call BMBB, the building that was funded 2 years ago. That'll be move-in in September. The faculty are here. It's move-in ready, and that'll be fully operational this fall. So what we have put in place is a university-wide planning process. We have hired leaders and teams. We have been through the state designer selection board and are ready to contract with architects, landscape architects, and engineers. The faculty are done designing the programs that will go in here, and we are moving into final design and will be construction ready within the year. So I guess I would conclude my brief comments by saying, as far as I understand the shovel-ready jargon that's being used, this is very close to being shovel-ready. It is clearly an economic stimulus, and it gives Minnesota a position in biosciences instead of us rapidly becoming a flyover or flyby state. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, Mr. Chair.
Question for Mr. Sarah on the proposal. Mr. Sarah, one of the reasons, of course, and members, I know that you're almost ready to go on the first building, and I didn't eliminate the bonding for the first building, and I just assumed that you could probably come back for building 2, 3, and 4, because members, the way that this was financed to get around our 3% limit, I believe it was, or kind of create what was the university issued the bonds, and it's a complicated issue, but we have to carry the payment for the bonds in our higher education budget. So by doing what I did, we saved $1.38 million in 2011 and $14.4 million in 12 and 13. And, I don't disagree with you or contest the fact, Dr. Sarah, that we have to, we have got a great research university, but these are tough times, and I thought we could maybe visit this issue again when you got the funding and you promised to raise private money. I don't know how that's going. Maybe you can answer that question, but you promised to raise private money to match the public financing, and then that you could come as you were starting construction on a new building, and maybe in the next year's bonding bill ask again for another building to show the legislature that you had actually begun construction on the first building, because there was 4 finance members, if I recall correctly, for was it $250 million, $280 million. Dr. Sarah, I can't remember. So maybe you can answer that first about how the funding is going, the private funding, and when the new construction will start on the first building, and then when you anticipate you can put some package together to begin on the second, and maybe on the third, and on the fourth, and how far out there we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the fundraising is already occurring. You've seen some of that in the paper. Private donors are coming forward to help this. You've seen the funding for the Schultz Diabetes Institute, which is part of this. You've seen the funding for the Masonic Cancer Center from the Masons organization that is very much part of this, as one of these buildings is devoted to cancer cures. And there are ongoing discussions with donors. I can also tell you there are ongoing discussions with major developers who are looking at developing sites near these facilities for new startup companies, for accelerators, and so on. And sending this message is likely to just stop all of those discussions. We've received a great deal of national attention as a state because of the foresight in funding these facilities. It's enabled us to recruit faculty like we've never been able before and to plan ahead. So let me get to your second specific question. The construction on CMRR is slated for this fall. We are well into the beginning of the design on the cancer center and plan to start that within the next 12 months.
Is that the second building?
That's the second building. We have the faculty in place to fill that facility. The third one is on cardiac disease, and that will be going into final design. Will be ready construction about a year after the first one. Mr. Chair, we had a very long series of discussions debating the point of how the bill is currently written and coming back in each bonding cycle around the needs of the university in a competitive market to recruit the faculty, to attract the venture, to attract the donors with a higher degree of certainty that in fact this would happen. But I think in its wisdom, the legislature built into the current bill that we have to go back, I believe, to the Commissioner of Finance and show that we in fact have completed the first project and have the plans in place for the second project before we can proceed with that bonding.
Other questions of Mr. Serra? Dr. Serra, let me just say this in front of the committee. I will work with you, and maybe we'll have to take this out. I'm still really uncomfortable that, you know, the way that the whole payment schedule was set up and the fact that this committee has to carry, I believe, a few years out there. Mr. Berg helped me, but I think in the 20s, with the university, with the football stadium and this, I believe it's, 25 million a year for like 20 years on the tail end of this out there to pay for a stadium and then these four buildings in a very creative financing way. And so I was just trying to save a little money for the committee and maybe use it in other areas where we could actually do something to help the students. I do not want to, you know, be the one to be blamed for, heaven forbid, for costing all kinds of jobs and saving the world. So we'll talk about this if you want. If somebody wants to offer an amendment to pull it out now,
Chair,
they're more than free to, but I would like to discuss this with you and several of your other people who are in the room if my committee would grant me that request, and we will work on it. And you can inform me furthermore because of what's going to happen, because I just want the committee members to know that maybe I'll be long dead and gone. You know, the way this session is going, I'm kind of wishing for it. That's a wish. But, you know, this committee and the members that are going to be sitting on it years from now are going to be carrying a debt of 20-some million dollars a year to pay for a football stadium and these four buildings in this committee. Money that could have been used otherwise to do other things. So, any further questions, Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair and Dr. Serra, but I'll address my comments to the chair. I support your bill, and I work with you as much as we can here. And I would have supported you if you had done just the football stadium.
That's built. Probably got to be.
Well, as anyone who stops in my office understands how I feel about that particular football stadium.
How many hours did you get on that project, Representative Mulling?
I wouldn't have worked on it if they'd offered me a job on that stadium. But the idea of shutting down the bioscience buildings at the U, although I understand how difficult it is for us to pull this budget together. This has been a very tough year for us, and it's going to continue to be a tough year. But these five buildings, combined with some of the other work that we've done, really get us to the, not the head of the line, but puts us in the line to be a top flight biomedical, high-tech, economic development center. And Dr. Serra is correct. I don't know about the fundraising, but the the spin-off companies, the energy that's been generated around this particular buzz, whether you want to look at it nationwide or worldwide, and the bump in recruitment of top-notch, world-class scientists and the people that they bring with is right on the money. This is, I'm sure you're going to be speaking with the university. This would probably be the one area, Mr. Chair, that you and I would have some disagreement in your bill. And I hope that in your conversations with the university, you can find some way to get these buildings back on track.
Well, members, I promise you I will meet with Mr. Sarah and others at the university, but in your own presentation here, it sounds like before the second building even starts, we're close into the next biennium already. And that's why I, you know, thought that maybe we could save a little money, as I said, by what I have on bill. So I don't disagree with you at all, Representative Mahoney, the importance of these buildings and these research. I do have a little problem with, you know, the university going from one of their natural resources that built this great university, mines, to mines. But I still think you should be concentrating a little more on our natural resources than you do, particularly mining in this state. But be that as it may, I understand the importance and the job development and everything else that goes along with it and the benefits for humanity. But these are tough times, and I was looking at ways to save money. Representative Welton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Sarah, thank you very much for coming up and addressing this issue. And I would just echo some of the same comments as my colleague, Representative Mahoney. In Rochester, of course, we have the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Partnership, and we're just starting to see the breakthroughs in some of the research. And the breakthroughs are going to be transitioning from the research facility out into the marketplace and out into health to improve lives, not only here in Minnesota, but throughout the country and throughout the world. But beyond that, we've seen a tremendous amount of synergy since that partnership has been created. Not too far down the road in Representative Poppy's district, we have the Hormel Institute. Between IBM, Mayo, the University of Minnesota, and the Hormel Institute, there is tremendous opportunity for growth in Minnesota from that area. And some states, you know, we refer to, a research triangle. Here in Minnesota, I think it's just going to be a matter of time before we're really recognized throughout the world as a leader in health science research. We already are, but I just think the synergy is great. But beyond that, one of the important things that I've heard over and over and over again is the need for long-term funding and the need for long-term planning. And I think by putting this provision in the bill, we jeopardize that long-term planning. If you have the long-term funding in place, if you have the long-term planning in place, then you can recruit the top-notch researchers from throughout the world. They're not interested in relocating someplace for 6 months or possibly a year, given the political climate or the economic climate where you may lose your research funding. They're going where the dollars are. They're going where they have a long-term plan in place and long-term funding in place. And so I would encourage you, before this bill gets to the House floor, to have something worked out and to put us back in the position of having a long-term plan in the state of Minnesota.
And Representative Welty, again, I have no disagreement with what you said, what Representative Mahoney said. I have toured the facility down in Rochester. I believe this committee gave permanent funding that you should be appreciative and proud of down in Rochester. I've been to the Hormel facility, which is extremely impressive, and know of the synergy that's going on there between Mayo and the university and the Hormel facility. So I'm very aware of that. Keep in mind that what you brought up about the ongoing funding also is a something that this committee will have to deal with in the future when the bodies start going into the building, and then the determination about what this great university of ours, our land-grant university, concentrates on as far as educating our public students, as far as the research itself and the outreach to our community. So it's all something that works in to the pot of money we've got to work with, and I will heed all of your words, and I know, you know, that that I've got to do something. I'm glad I brought this up to our attention, because to everybody's attention, because Dr. Sarah, you know, you'll be coming back probably to ask us to help fund some of the positions in that too. So, you know, that's going to cost money in the future too, Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add that I think we need to send a positive message. That's basically what you're saying we're going to do, so that the university can continue in the direction they're on without worrying about us pulling out the rug from underneath them. So.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Mahoney, are you ready to do the 827 amendment?
Yes, sir, I am.
Or is it the 828 amendment? It got fixed up the pages the past few months. Representative Mahoney offers the 828 amendment, members, that deals with workers' compensation ombudsman. Representative Mahoney, move the 828 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 828 amendment creates an ombudsman in the workers' compensation division, with the chief judge appointing this ombudsman and staffing, providing staff to him. The duties of the ombudsman is to assist injured workers to get through the the technical issues that go on at workers' compensation and the court systems that get through it. You know, it's not an issue in the construction trade, because there's a little bit smoother path, but those not in the construction trades have a little bit rougher of a path. And it comes out of the Office of Legislative Auditor, and one of their key recommendations is that the legislature should establish an ombudsman for workers' compensation. And to that note, Mr. Chair, this bill has been out for quite a bit, and I've gotten a couple of letters that, you know, tell me I'm doing the right thing, because I've gotten labor upset, I've got business upset, I've got the lawyers upset. I think I got them all. But I don't think I have injured workers upset. The number of emails and letters and phone calls I've gotten from injured workers supporting this particular concept has been amazing. And but before I go too far along on that, I'd like if we could bring down the Office of Legislative Auditors and the person who wrote the report, Ms. Yunan, I think I'm saying the name right, and let her explain how the Office of Legislative Auditors came to this idea and what they thought this ombudsman could do.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, ma'am. If you just say your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Deborah Parker-Zanot. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and as Representative Mahoney said, I manage our evaluation of workers' compensation that was released in February of this year. And one of the strongest recommendations that came out of this report was that the legislature establish an ombudsperson for injured workers. Let me just give you a little background on the support for that recommendation. First, we surveyed thousands of injured workers in Minnesota who had filed claims for workers' comp in 2006 and 2007, or were involved in a workers' comp dispute during that time. And for many, the system is working the way that it's supposed to. You know, they're filing their claims, they're getting their benefits, and getting back to work, just as we would hope. But for a significant portion, the system is not working the way that it should. Most of these workers in the subgroup interacted with the workers' comp dispute resolution process. We found that process to be overly complex, too lengthy, and litigious. And, you know, I said we sent out thousands of surveys, and I was the contact person on for all of those. And I received dozens and dozens and dozens of phone calls and letters, in some cases full medical case files. I didn't get x-rays to review, but just about. And it is clear, it was very clear to us, that there are workers who are lost and overwhelmed in this system. They are lost and overwhelmed. The Department of Labor and Industry does have a dispute resolution process and dispute resolution staff in place, but to do their job, they need to be impartial in really considering the views of those businesses and workers who are involved in disputes. And we clearly see the need for some other role, another role that needs to be filled, and that's why we recommended the ombudsperson. This person's office would provide advice and counsel from a worker or business's point of view. There are several models already in state government for ombudspersons. For example, the Department of Human Services has an ombudsperson for managed care. For example, Minnesotans who are enrolled in Minnesota Care, for example, could go to the ombudsperson for managed care if they're having a dispute or an issue regarding their care. We have an ombudsperson for mental health and developmental disabilities. The Department of Revenue has the Taxpayer Rights Advocate Office, which is, in essence, an ombudsperson office. And the Minnesota Board on Aging has an ombudsperson for long-term care. So, but to us, this ombudsperson for workers' compensation would fill a very similar role, provide a single point of contact, a fresh look at individual situations, help with problem solving, and suggest options for dilemmas for people who are having a hard time navigating this system. So, you know, with that, Mr. Chair, it really was probably one of the strongest recommendations from the report this year.
Questions of Ms. Janot. Did I say your name right?
You did.
J-A-N-A-D?
J-U-N-O-D.
J-U-N-O-D. Okay. Questions of Mr. Janot. Ms. Janot.
Just real briefly, Mr. Janot, did it, as far as the recommendation goes, where would the ombudsperson come from? Representative Mahoney has had a couple different ideas on making that appointment. I think one was originally perhaps the commissioner, now we've got the one that would be essentially the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals Chief Judge. Did the auditor have a recommendation with respect to where that ombudsperson would come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Adkins, not a specific recommendation other than the fact that it should be outside of the Department of Labor and Industry's Workers' Compensation Division. It should be definitely separate. There are different models out there. One, as the Department of Revenue, the Taxpayer Rights Advocate reports directly to the commissioner. The ombudsperson for mental health and developmental disabilities through his own entity. So there are a lot of different models out there. We just recommended that it not be within the workers' compensation itself.
Okay, testimony from anybody else for or against the bill? I see Mr. Leto, and we have, looks like, labor and industry coming up, I hope, with two different opinions. Welcome to the committee, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brad Leto, Chief Staff for the
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I apologize. Representative Overmuller, Detmer, and Anderson. Were your questions to Mr. Ms. Janot?
No.
Yes. Who said yes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Janot, would you come back down for a second? I apologize. Representative Detmer. I had tunnel vision on this one.
Me too.
Okay.
Representative Detmer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Adkins did ask part of my question of where this person would come from, which you really don't know right now, but is there an extra cost involved here for a fiscal note for this type of position? Number two,
go ahead.
Doesn't the local union also provide this type of service to its employees?
I don't know if Mr. Nod can answer either of those questions, but I can answer the first one, and the answer would be that this would be paid out of the workers' comp, just like the fund, like the judges' where judges are, and like most of the Department of Labor and Industry is, in fact.
Okay.
So it would come out of the statute for businesses on workers' compensation. I don't know the answer to the second question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dettmer, I personally know of no local union that has an ombudsman. There very well may be one or two, but I don't think the majority of unions, and frankly, unions only represent 15-20% at the maximum of employees in the state of Minnesota, so at least 80% of the workers that wouldn't be served if there was that particular service through a local union.
Thank you.
Representative Gottfried, did you have a comment on that?
Representative
Mahoney, Mr. Dunn, thank you then. Would the two witnesses come down then? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad Leto, the Chief of Staff of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And we would at this time oppose the amendment. I think all legislators should have gotten a letter some time ago in the Senate when they heard the bill. One of the senators asked me to try and get the labor members of the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council together, which we did as quickly as possible, and they actually had four of the six in a meeting in our office, and then we talked to the other two after that fact, and they agreed unanimously that while the idea may have some merit, it needs some work. And we have committed, and I can certainly provide copies of the letter if you haven't seen it yet. We did send it March 27th, 26th, and 27th, that we would work on this for next year, and there's a couple of reasons why we don't think it's necessarily ready for prime time. First of all, other states and I've done very little bit of research that I could in the time that I've had. I think in the memo that I provided, Oregon and Kansas had extensive ombudsman's offices. They have nine and eight people respectively in their offices. I know that Oregon gets 1,000 calls a month to their office and opens claims, and they've actually started with, I think, five, and now they're at nine people in their office. Kansas has eight people in Kansas. They did the figures were that manage their own cases when they get complex are successful 2% of the time, injured workers. Also, these states call their ombudsman injured workers ombudsman. I see in the bill it's for employers and employees. So I would just present that as well. Some of the other states just that I Googled that I was able to find: Alabama, Kentucky, Florida, as I said, Kansas, Texas. Those states all have, just for your knowledge, higher costs per $100 of payroll than Minnesota, and lower benefits than the state of Minnesota. So maybe you could say that an ombudsman decreases the amount of benefits. I would hope that would not be the case. But I guess the point of all of this is that I think it needs a lot more work. And I'm committing to you right now, and in fact, because the members of the Advisory Council did in the letter that they're prepared to come back with a proposal for next year. And it may be more extensive. It may be a number of people in an office as well. So that's and I do know that there's probably, with the number of injured workers, and I know the auditor said 13% of cases actually go to or disputed. If it was that, you're talking about tens of thousands of people. And so I think it's, to have one or two people in an office that this would be difficult to handle. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we just save the questions after Mr. Estenson presents his case. You guys want to hold hands or anything while you're up there?
It's up to Mr. Leto. Jeremy Estenson, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll be brief for many of the same reasons that Mr. Leto pointed out. The chamber is currently opposing this language. While we feel the idea may have some merit, we are just asking that the Work Comp Advisory Council be allowed to vet
vet this idea and work with the department to figure out a way to best administer it that suits the needs of the injured workers and the providers and the payers all the best. And so we're asking that we be able to come back next year with something that's been vetted and discussed by the Work Comp Advisory Council.
Representative Oldenmuller. Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the questions that I have aren't for these two guys here, but more for Representative Mahoney.
Okay, well, then, if there are no questions, just let me, say to both the gentlemen on the Workers' Comp Advisory Council and itself, I don't think, other than Representative Murphy, I've been around here to have seen the whole Workers' Comp issue, which was a really tough issue back in the 80s and the early 90s, and in 92 we had a bill that we thought would help, and it was a pretty good bill where we made everybody sacrifice, insurance companies, workers, injured workers, QRCs or QCRs, whatever the qualified view, QRCs, and then in 95 and everybody said, well, we can't do anything without the advisory council approving it. Well, in 95 we had a terrible amendment on the House floor that to this day has not been rectified, and injured workers, when they reach MMI, a lot of times maximum medical improvement, end up losing their jobs through no fault of their own. And, you really haven't come forward, the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, I don't think, with a lot of initiatives that help those people get back to work or help them fix their lives after, through no fault of their own, they get hurt at work. And, members, for those of you that don't know, Mr. Leto is from Embarrass, Minnesota, the coldest spot in the nation, and my former committee administrator when I was chair of state government finance, and good labor man, but I am just flabbergasted and astounded today. And, being the moderate that I am, I don't like to get bullied by the chamber or bullied by a union thug. And poor lawyers. I think this is really a good idea and a good start and point of discussion. And
Mr. Chair, I just want
Mr. Leto, I'm sorry, you're not that bad of a union thug, but
Perhaps you're referring to the president who was here last night waiting for the amendment, but couldn't be here today. He's at a union bank meeting, of course, which has good assets and has had no bailout funds at this point. Just to let you know, last year, the bill that came in from the advisory council, through no fault of not having hours and hours and hours and hours of meetings with various people, does not have much in it. Last year, or the year before, actually, and to the business committee's credit, benefits were increased in that bill. The maximum, which had not been increased in a long time, the temporary partial, temporary total with that was increased 6 months, and a retraining was expanded, the period for retraining was expanded. The business community went along with that, and actually, to be quite honest, they went along with it and they got nothing in the bill in that year. So, it is very difficult. I agree. And going back to the, I know nobody here probably remembers, certainly I remember with you, Mr. Chair, the wars of the of many years going through the legislature. And certainly it's up to the legislature prerogative if they want to go back to that. That's fine. Well, thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, I...
Well, wait, no, Representative Andrew, Representative Mahoney, go ahead.
Right. Mr. Chair, I brought this bill forward to get this discussion started. I am flabbergasted that you would sit at that particular table and say this idea may have merit. I'm getting dozens and dozens of calls through an editorial and through this bill of injured workers that are having nothing but nightmares going through the system. And no lawyer, no business person, no labor guy, no labor thug, other than myself, came to my office to talk to me about this. I got a letter on this. I've been invited to the, apparently you're having a meeting in June, and I have gotten, the Workers' Comp Board is having a meeting in June, and I was invited to this particular thing. I don't know where the heck it is anymore. It's up on my desk. I'm going to pull this amendment, but I'll tell you right now, if there's not something in front of me that looks like it's actually going to help workers with an ombudsman next year, this bill will be back, and I won't pull the bill. And I'm going to be a bit of a SOB on trying to help these guys next year. I'm not on the Workers' Comp Commission, but I'm going to stick my nose into it, and I will go to the meetings and try to figure out, because there's some good examples. I mean, you may use Kansas, you may use, you know, the other states. I've got a list of them upstairs that I'm going through their laws to try to figure out how we can get a decent ombudsman. And, Mr. Chair, I'm frustrated with this, and I don't want to have those phone calls from my constituents anymore. I'm tired of it. And with that, I'll pull the 828 amendment.
Pull the 828 amendment, and I hope that Mr. Esten and Lecto heard the conversation. Representative Gunter, do you have any comments, Representative Anderson? Do you want to? Okay, Representative Gunter? No. Representative Norner?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add that, you know, one of the jobs, at least as I see my job as a legislator, I think sometimes we operate in that same arena of being an ombudsman. When somebody calls me, I work as hard as I can to find a solution to their problem. So I think in lieu of anything happening here, I think each of us has a responsibility to deal with our constituents and help them through the maze that they might find themselves in. So when I receive a call, I work very hard to find a solution to the problem. So in lieu of this, I think all of us have a responsibility to help our constituents instead of just saying, well, wait till we get an ombudsman and then things will be good. So
I think you're right there, Representative Norris, and I often do when I called Mr. Rakowski and Commissioner Swigum, and I've been doing it for years, but sometimes it doesn't help much either, and you know that.
I just wanted to say that obviously, as I said before, we take this seriously and we'll look at it. The other thing that I do want to mention, I know Representative Mahoney mentioned the fact that he's going to be watching this. I would encourage and have for years and would encourage and we, that all of the members of the, and certainly the labor members of the Advisory Council would encourage, if you have issues that you want us to look at, please forward them. I mean, please forward them. You can forward them to Ray Waldron or the commissioner or anybody, and I can certainly get you emails for that. But I would certainly urge you to do that so that we can look at them, because I think some of the other issues that have been put forth have been pushed by other folks, including the commissioner, that maybe don't have a lot of mileage, quite honestly. And so I would encourage that. The other thing is the auditor's report, just so you know, I mean, I think we need to look at that in total, because there are a lot of recommendations in the auditor's report, including ones where the department needs to improve. Well.
Representative Gunter, thank you very much. And Representative Gunter, on this issue and then your amendment, the 0439 amendment, too.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to make a couple comments. I just got an email from a guy that had a workplace injury 6 years ago, and he's been waiting 6 years to get the first dime from the insurance company, and he has done everything he possibly can do. He's went to court 3 times and prevailed it all 3 times. The company, just simply to have one person fight a big insurance company is just like, it's worse than David going against Goliath. And it really is a tragedy when you look at what some people have to go through to get what they deserve.
I know. That's the bottom line. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Representative Gunter offers the 0439 amendment, and Ms. Newman has a oral amendment to the amendment. This is the amendment we heard last night, members. that now we have been told by finance that the money didn't cancel and that it won't be counted against the committee. Ms. Newman, do you want to offer the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on line, page 1, line 26 of the amendment. And after 2009, we would insert the word special revenue fund to clarify where the appropriation came from.
Okay. Everyone understands that Representative Gunter offers, or just incorporates that into the amendment. Representative Gunter.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the amendment we had last night. Simply establishes Minnesota Green Enterprise Assistance through deed, with deed in agreement that this is a good place to put it. The money is now not in doubt anymore, and I appreciate the chairman's work and Chairman Hilty and Chairman Genius. I went to see all of them today, and none of them claimed it, but they all finally found out because of Chairman Rukavina that the money hasn't been spent and is available, and the Senate is trying to go through the same process. And basically, this is to do the thing that, part of the thing that this committee is for, is to help create jobs and industries within the state. And I think it's a good amendment. Please vote for it.
Okay, any other questions? If not, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Welty offers the A23 amendment. Representative Welty, this is the, I believe, the deletion on page 55 of the combative sports appropriation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I was here 4 years ago when we put in the, we reinstated the Combative Sports Commission, provided them funding at the time. I think we were told in the committee that the Combative Sports Commission at some time would become self-sustaining, and we had to reinstate it after there were some issues with the administration of the commission. We're faced with that issue once again. As many of you probably know, there was a legislative audit report that came out this year that said that there were still issues with the management of the Combative Sports Commission. I have supported it twice. At this point, I'm no longer willing to support it. They knew what they were supposed to do to fix that commission and to make sure that the issues were resolved, and that legislative auditor's report came out again this year stating that they still have issues. The governor recommended zeroing out the Combative Sports Commission. I would hope that we would also zero out the Combative Sports Commission, save the dollars. We're going to need them going into the next biennium. And members, I'll keep it that brief.
Members, I think, you know, that we've heard the testimony from Mr. Ledoux, and I think that they are trying to get moved towards self-sufficiency, and I hope we can keep it going, because I believe then that there won't be any events at all, and maybe some of you like that. I don't know that. If Representative Welty, if we cut the, could I suggest an amendment to your amendment that we cut the appropriation to $75,000? Would you consider that?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't at this point.
Well, members,
if you want to readdress this in Finance Committee or some other committee, you know, you're able to do that since you're going to be carrying this bill. But at this time, I think I'd like our committee to vote on it and have a position on this issue.
Representative Haas and then Murphy.
Thank you very much. And maybe you can answer me, you know, what you're talking about. If you did this, the worst would be not having the event. I think the worst would be to have the events without the safeguards, without a proper refereeing, without proper medical, without proper regulation, without proper knowledge, and still have the event, because I think there could be very increasing in the danger of the activity. So,
Representative Haas, you're right, and you know, this has gone from the boxing commission to the combative sports with those
you know, a different ultimate fighting and everything else, which they evidently had a very successful event that did raise them some revenue last year, but don't have one scheduled until, I think, in 2010. But anyway, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I strongly recommend that we vote this amendment down. I think that they've come a long way. They're addressing the problems of the legislative auditor. There's still room for some growth, but what we had to start with 4 years ago and what we have today is entirely different, and we have a working commission that's going forward now, and I think we should give them the chance to grow. Last night we had a dissolution, which I opposed. This would be a murder. And I just strongly oppose murder. And I strongly oppose dissolutions for that matter. But Mr. Chair, I remember the discussions where those people came in to testify that no, nothing would ever work, this would not work kind of thing, we have to have our own little commission kind of thing. And they're all working together now, and so let's go forward.
I like the way you put things, Representative Murphy. Representative Gunter, I think you were involved in this.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly don't want to get on a bad side today, so I agree with her 100%. I really believe that the Combative Sports Commission has a role in limiting state liability for sanctioning public events. And I think that's why we have a boxing board to begin with. And we gave our responsibility for boxing board to Iowa. They then discontinued theirs, so we thought it was a big enough liability that we wanted to take it on in Minnesota again. And so now we have one. We are trying to get the thing functioning well. When it was a boxing board, we spent about $75,000 a year before. This was back 8-10 years ago. Now we have a Combative Sports Commission that represents 8 different venues of fighting sports. And I think that, as Representative Murphy said, they're getting along better. We're trying to help them become more efficient. Representative Rocavina, Chairman Rocavina, trying to help effect a more affordable office space for them so we can make them more efficient. So I think I oppose your amendment, because I think this is something that's going in the right direction, and I think it absolves the state from some liability that they would have without it.
Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe last year I tried making some changes to this particular item and offered to bring boxing gloves and take you on, but never have done that. I'm supportive of Representative Welty's efforts here, and I'll tell you, it's not because I don't think we need the state's protection, but as I understand it, before I got to this body, there was a promise that it would be a biennium only $50,000. Then when I got here, we were told it would be, again, a small appropriation, limited, and it would stand on its own. And now here we go again. And in a year when I'm sitting through 5 committees and cutting people off services, it just irks me once again to be told they're making progress. That progress should have been made 4 years ago or before. And so I guess I wish Representative Welty had taken you up on the 75, because I think that would have been a nice compromise, because I'm afraid his amendment's going to go down. But I would encourage you that if we don't get the support for Representative Welty, that you seriously consider lowering this amount in finance and taking into consideration the drastic cuts that we will be making in the state and where our priorities should be in the future.
Representative Deffern.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe on a lighter side, maybe we could combine the Combative Sports Commission with the cosmetology or the barbers.
Knew that was coming.
And
it's lost the fight.
Here we go.
Then referee.
And no further questions. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion does not prevail. Representative Bly offers the A15 amendment. Representative Bly.
This is the amendment I brought before to
delete the study from the Ag Special Corps livestock sighting and zoning. And you asked that I meet with Representative Welty, and we did meet. I did get him some possible language to start a conversation with, and some other suggestions. He indicated he wasn't interested in them, and so I believe I'm convinced now more than I was before that deleting the study is perhaps the only solution I have. And my contention in bringing it before was that this is an issue that's been studied a great deal, mentioned the study, generic and environmental impact statements on animal agriculture, and did find I had difficulty locating a copy before. In my ignorance, I didn't go to the best place I should have gone, which is our legislative library, and of course they have the 12 volume study up there, collecting dust, and there are two volumes dealing with this issue. I did bring down three of them so you could see. This morning I did a little Google of Minnesota livestock studies on zoning and siting, and there were numerous studies. The one from the World Bank in 2005, our own livestock task force study on siting and zoning in 2005. And then a study in 2009 in Edmonton about understanding and managing livestock issues. And it just seems to me that the university could spend its time doing other things that would really benefit agriculture. And I, in talking with Representative Welty, he mentioned this is a contentious issue. He wanted to keep the language as neutral as possible. And I think that's what worries me, is that even though the language may be neutral, we don't know the direction it's going in, and I think, you know, you had encouraged us to look at some comfort language to the folks who are concerned about what direction that study might go in. And I guess in light of the fact that it looks like there's lots of research out there already on this issue, and it will open up some old wounds that have been there between different groups in agriculture, I think deleting the study from the special would be the thing to do.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Black, I'm not really familiar with this issue, and I don't know what all the different groups are. What are the concerns that it would lead to?
Representative Black.
Well, I think, you know, of course it depends, and I don't know who's brought forward the idea for the study, but it does depend on which direction you're going in. But in my area, constituents are very concerned about local control, and being able to decide what kind of livestock development happens in their area, and also looking at protecting, in a sense, the wide variety of different types of agriculture we have. We're worried about some groups being kind of closed out by information that might come from one one still part of the argument and not the other, you know. So what I was looking for in the study was some language that would give me some comfort that if a study was done, it would look fairly at the issue, and that I would have some clarity about what direction it was going in. And I even suggested that perhaps we move the study from the Shell part of the bill to the May part of the bill, so that, you know, the university had more discretion about what direction they would go in.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, so if I'm hearing you correctly, is this an issue of feedlots, and you're just worried that the local community wouldn't have the opportunity to have their say on feedlot construction or large
production? I think feedlots are a central part of the issue, yes. I guess, you know, what I'm saying is that there have been lots of studies about this issue. It seems pretty clear that the two sides of the issue understand the issues related to it. I don't know what value there is in having another study. It does cause anxiety to a number of my constituents and others who might be concerned about what direction the study would go in or who's behind it.
Representative Welty.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, just to bring you up to speed, you probably remember hearing this discussion, I don't know, it was a couple weeks ago, and at that time I'd asked Representative Lai to bring me the study that they had referenced, and we had a follow-up discussion, and we talked about the issue, and no study was ever produced, and then today I just see it land on the table. So I haven't had a chance to look at studies that have been done. I don't know if they address necessarily what we're looking at. First of all, I'll just say this. This recommendation is coming from the Agriculture Committee. The Agriculture Committee, as I explained it before, 4 years ago or 2 years ago, began putting together what issues that are currently facing livestock that we want to have addressed and give the university a little bit more guidance. I will just read to you the language that's on page 13. It says, this appropriation includes funding for an analysis of livestock facility sightings and regulatory models from other states and countries. That's it. We are not asking the University of Minnesota to make any recommendations. We are just asking them to do an analysis of the models that exist in other states and other countries. The Agriculture Committee would like to have this information to look at because siting of livestock facilities is still an issue in Minnesota. We hear about it from various groups. The reason why we are asking the University of Minnesota to do this is exactly one of the reasons why Representative Bly brought this issue forward, saying groups have been shut out. Yes, in the past, this issue is very contentious. Who do we go for the most unbiased research? We go to our universities. This issue I'll just let you know, this issue in the last couple of weeks has really been blown out of proportion. People are saying that there's a slant to this, but I just want you to know, after reading this language, I think all of you can see, this language is written in the most neutral position possible. We're just asking the university to do analysis from other states and other countries and give us a report in the Ag Committee so we can reference the information and make determinations based upon that information how we want to proceed in the state of Minnesota. There is in no way any indication whatsoever from the Ag Committee or this language which route we're going to choose to take. And the issue of local control, I will say this, there is no attempt in here whatsoever to take away any form of local control.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the explanation. In looking at this, does this include sites that are currently there for livestock or future sites? How does that work?
Representative Bly, or do you want to address that?
Well, we don't know. What I was looking for in hoping to get some language that might give me some reassurance was some fleshing out of what that might be or what the study might be looking for. When we have the university do studies, it depends on what questions get asked or who they meet with to design the study. And I still don't have the assurance that this will be, even though the language describing the study may be neutral, that the study itself will be neutral. And no reflection on the university, but the university starts with whomever they begin to work with, who's kind of bringing the emphasis for the study forward.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, many times we have farmers that have been existing farms for years, and all of a sudden you have urban development around that farm, and a lot of times you have some conflicts there. So is this a study to look at those aspects, or is it just any future sites? That was my question.
I don't know if you can answer that.
Right.
Sure. Representative, or Chair Rukavina and Representative Detmer, what we're simply asking for is look at the models that exist in other states and other countries. There's nothing in here that says that we'll be analyzing what we currently do within the state. And then beyond that, I just want to bring up one thing because the question emerged over here, and I know some of you do not represent agricultural areas, so I just want to let you know what this is about. This is essentially about where you place a facility, where you raise sheep, horses, beef cows, dairy cows. This is about animal agriculture and where that animal agriculture is located. and outside of the metropolitan area in our rural communities or outside of larger cities. This is an issue that emerges often, and we want to make sure that in Minnesota we have a good process in place, and we want to, the Ag Committee wants to have unbiased research and information that we can look at when addressing.
Representative Norner.
Mr. Chair, just a question. I know we fund the Extension Service and the university. Do we always have language included in our bill? It looks to me like it belongs in the Agriculture Committee and not this committee.
Well, Representative Norner, what I do, you know, is I wake up in the morning and I have a cup of coffee with my roommate, Representative Junkie, who chairs the Ag Committee, and then he tells me how he's going to spend our money here. So then what I do is, since Representative Welty sits on both committees, I let Junkie and Welty decide how they're going to spend our money here. And we did have a number of things spelled out in the bill 2 years ago. And I think members should know this is also my former roommate and previous roommate. I've gone through a few of them. It seems they room with me and they get defeated. But Junkie's been around a while now. But former Representative Winter called me over the Easter break and asked me if I would support Representative Bly on this. And I promised him I would. And I told Representative Welty that because, you know, I think I have to agree with Representative Bly that there have been a lot of studies, and I'm not that much one for studies, but I supported some of them. But if you look on the appropriation page of $52+ million a year that we're giving to the Ag, and includes Extension Service also, and there's them spelled out by the Ag Committee, a lot of things they want this $52 million to look at. And
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask the question is, this language also in the Ag Bill somewhere? So if we're amending this part of it, does it have to be amended in another location?
No, it isn't in the Ag Bill. This is a recommendation the Ag Committee made to us for the Ag Special at the university.
Okay.
But I would, you know, hope that we could go along with Representative Bly for now, and then that these two gentlemen could play nice and maybe work on some language as it moves forward. And I don't know if there's anything that stops the university from doing a study within this without the language too. So we've heard the discussion. All those in favor of the by amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
All those in favor, raise your hand. All those opposed, raise your hand. Okay, the motion does not prevail. I will clean the wax out of my ears after the meeting. Representative, I have the last amendment. And then we have some other corrections that have to be made. Members, I have the A29 amendment that's been passed out. And a couple of years ago, there was something put in that stopped holistic medicine folks from being able to get paid for workers' comp treatment. And so I see that we have people in the audience that they'd like to come down and explain the amendment that I said I would offer on behalf of their practice. And just if you want, welcome to the committee. The last one was the Hippie Farmer Amendment. I'm jokingly calling this the Hippie Healer Amendment. So welcome to the committee. And just identify yourself for the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I'm president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. I'm actually a hippie carpenter by trade. In our opinion, this is an issue of discrimination, and it seems like a strong word, and maybe it is, but it seems like it's discrimination against practitioners who are working under Chapter 146A, who have been charged, tried, and convicted, but there has been no crime. Nobody is alleging misuse let alone abuse by natural health practitioners of the work comp process, and yet they have been arbitrarily barred from the work comp system. This is unfair to progressive business insurers, and certainly unfair to consumers and workers who might want to access these practitioners. The change was not proposed by the Work Comp Advisory Council. It seems that it came primarily from the department, so it generally seems that the members of the Work Comp Advisory Council, whom we've spoken to, generally seem uncertain why the department brought this forward. It's not claimed to be a money-saving measure. It's the legislature's job to make the laws of the state, and it seems like the current status is indefensible in our opinion. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Catherine Berg, and I would be the hippie healer he was referring to. I'm a homeopath, and I'm also a parent. One of our biggest concerns about this is that the state, in particular, the Department of Labor and Industry, has gotten into the business of telling the insurance companies what they can do and what they can't do. And so it has these unintended consequences. It ties the hands of workers' comp insurance companies and also those self-insured companies from doing this if they want to. So what if a cutting-edge insurance company came into Minnesota and said, we really think that this will save money, which, by the way, it would, and we want to cover these? They would not be able to do that. And it probably the more likely scenario actually is a company with self-insurance for workers' compensation. And so we feel this is not up to the state to decide. It's up to, they should not erect these artificial restrictions that inhibit innovation by workers' compensation insurance companies. Repealing this in no way requires that workers' compensation insurance companies cover these services by 146A practitioners. As always, they can refuse a claim. And there is a precedence in Minnesota law of reimbursing unlicensed therapies. You can get an approval by a physician or chiropractor. A no-fault insurance covers these therapies on a reimbursement basis, and I know that personally, that has happened. Now, the last thing I want to bring up is that the Department of Labor and Industry will tell you that there is an exception. There's an exemption to this. And the department says that if the practitioner is under the supervision of a licensed practitioner, but this isn't law, it's a rule, and it refers to ancillary medical workers who aren't licensed but for whom their services need to be billed. And this way licensing laws are set up in Minnesota, it's nearly impossible for a licensed person to hire an unlicensed 146A practitioner because they give up responsibility and they can actually put themselves in the direct line of the medical board. And this has happened before, not in a work comp situation, but in other types of situations. The lack of legal ability to practice these natural therapies by these licensed practitioners makes it impractical for them to actually provide knowledgeable oversight to 146A practitioners. So the exemption is really pointless and it's impractical, and it really isn't an exemption at all.
Members, so what I'm trying to do here is I think this is a often a very inexpensive way for treatment for an injured worker, and I'd appreciate your support, and I have to amend it. I think on page one, line 1.3 to say page 146 after line 2, and then that would be put the amendment in its form. And I thank you. Any questions of Ms. Berg or Mr. Schmidt? Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was wondering if we could have Dolly come down and speak to this issue of the language that they had originally put in.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Rakowski,
Chairman, members, just provide a little background. This issue came before the legislature last year in our workers' comp bill, and I don't believe the advisory council has taken up this issue current year, so really not. I'm not authorized to support this. It didn't go through the advisory council, and I was outside for a few minutes. I missed some of the testimony. I apologize.
Well, members, I don't think this is a big issue at all. I don't think it's a cost. I think it could be a savings to the system, and oftentimes, you know, at one point, chiropractors and et cetera weren't, you know, eligible, or there were attempts to not allow them to treat workers' comp, and I can remember that issue way back when. So I was hoping for your support on this. I see Mr. Letso is here. Letso, you just want to identify yourself.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Brad Letso from the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We had, you know, a lengthy discussion on this before when it was put in, but I guess I have a question, and maybe I have the wrong statute here, but the repealer says 176-135 subdivision 1B, and I'm looking at the statute, and it says that this would have repealed the employer shall pay for reasonable value of nursing services provided by a member of the employee's family in cases of permanent total disability. Which is this?
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Lato, it's subdivision 1B, not subdivision 1 paragraph B. There is a subdivision 1B that deals with the alternative health care providers.
Well, I mean, yes, we had the debate before, Mr. Sorry about that, but I just want a clarification, but we did, you know, have the debate before, and we brought it up again with the folks from the employer side, I mean, employee side, and they decided not to put it back in, but certainly, I mean, just to let, just the disclosure, so, thank you.
I don't think that, Mr. Rakowski, maybe you can tell us what kind of claims have been made under this prior to the implementation of the ban, I guess. I mean, were there, I think it would be so minuscule, yes. So, I would appreciate the member's support. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. I have a question.
Representative Anderson, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about this. I would feel more comfortable with this if we followed standard practices in that this is unlicensed care that we're having. If we want to protect injured workers, I think it would be important that we have it so that it would have to be directed from a licensed care professional, that they would be able to use this kind of treatment in their recovery. I think that would be in line with what we currently do, and it would also just make sure that we have an extra protection for our workers.
Again, if I can bring this up, and Mr. Rakowski can you know, maybe document what I'm saying. I think there was a time, Representative Anderson, when a doctor had to refer an injured worker to a chiropractor. And, you know, we've moved on beyond that point. I think the fact that they're unlicensed is not, I mean, it's the insurance company still has to approve this. And I really do think that sometimes homeopathic natural health methods provide relief at a much cheaper cost to the insurance company and to the injured worker than, you know, normal accepted ones. So, you know, doctors, well, go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I serve on the licensing subcommittee, and we did have a bill that passed last year that did license a very tiny sliver of naturopaths. So if you're going to start getting into licensing versus non-licensing, we're going to limit it to, I think, 14 or something providers in the whole state of Minnesota. The unlicensed naturopaths, the registered or certified, I'm not sure what they're called right now, registered, is a whole different branch. So if you use the term licensing, you've cut out most of the providers, which I assume they would not support.
Keep in mind that what Ms. Berg said is that the insurance company is going to make the final determination on whether or not they're going to even pay the claim.
Well, Mr. Chair,
and Representative,
to the point that Representative Norton has made, my issue isn't that the licensed professional would not be able to. My issue is that they can't refer to an unlicensed holistic treater. My issue is that who refers them should be licensed. So it's a doctor that refers them to getting this treatment, and that's what standard practice is in the state of Minnesota, and that's the route that I think that we should go in order to protect our workers.
I think if you remember, Representative
Walker had a bill that dealt with that, and we had a big fight over it about whether people could, whether doctors would refer or not, and then, you know, so it isn't standard anymore, but I'll work with you on this if this amendment goes on to try to see if we can get some type of referral, whether it's a chiropractor or whatever, and working with them. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Members, if there are no other amendments, staff has some corrections that we would like to make. Representative Mahoney?
I just wanted to tell you and the committee that this morning I was talking to an old friend who is retiring, who happens to work for MenSQ, and in our bill, because that friend is retiring and is one of the kind of does some finance work for them, they probably won't be able to be replaced. So I'm going to see if we can get an amendment between here and one of the other committees. I'm a little fearful of doing amendments on the fly, so I'm going to try and work some language out that allows them to replace these people, because I don't want, you know, an untrained person doing finance or an untrained person doing human resources. So, because right now there's a hiring freeze, so we need to figure out a way that there's some escape for them in special instances. But I wanted you to be aware that I'm going to work on that.
Members, I want all of you, including Representative Mahoney, to be aware that I have also been talking to MenSQ about that, because there are those, you know, parts in the bill about not hiring administrators and administrators or whatever, and even, you know, like you said, a finance person that retires. So we're going to get some language. I've talked to some of the folks at MenSQ, and I don't see, I think they've all darted out of the room. We still have some university folks here. But we'll talk to them as the bill moves towards finance and maybe clarify that question, because it's Anson McCormick, in fact, really saying he's going to retire possibly soon, and we can give that job to Representative Haas, and he's raising his hand, but I don't think we could replace it right now. There was a question on that, so we'll have to take care of that. Ms. Newman, would you care to make those corrections in the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, there's three items, and there's technical corrections on appropriation riders. The first one is page 44, line 3. This is the funding for the Hugo tornado relief. On line 3, we need to remove the words "in fiscal year 2009. The next item is on page 46. It would be after the period on line 3. This is the Twin Cities RISE appropriation. We would add the following: funds unexpended in the first year are available for expenditure in the second year. And the third item is on page 47, line 35. This is the Minneapolis Summer Youth Employment. On line 35, delete $250,000 and insert $310,000. And that just changes the internal allocation of that appropriation between the Learn to Earn and the regular summer youth program.
On the last proposal, is that currently the way that's distribution is, Mr. Burr?
Mr. Chair, this appropriation is actually reduced by $100,000 for the two programs, and what this does
so
is
prorated.
it apportions it to the two programs.
All righty. Representative Mahoney makes those three changes, and are there any questions on them? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. That motion prevails. And members, I want to represent O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure this is an amendment that I'm offering yet, but I want to ask a clarification question on the tuition guarantee that Representative Diskins, I believe, was his bill. It was on page 27 and on page 29 for University of Minnesota. And that, as I understand it, would set a four-year tuition rate for individual college students, and with the cap we're putting on tuition, I'm just concerned that the tuition cap might make the four-year cost start out at the cost that we're setting for this year for new students coming in 2010, and then I think the testimony was that you had to increase the first-year cost in order to make it work over 4 years, and here we wouldn't be allowing them to do that. If you could just address that for me, I'd really appreciate it.
Better, would you care to come up and
do we have to, if we keep the Biskin language in the bill, and you know the issue, is there a problem with the capper? I assume that it let you adjust that, so go ahead.
Jerry Rukavina, Peter Zetterberg, University of Minnesota. I guess it all depends on how you interpret the language. I believe the language makes it a little bit unclear on when we would actually have to begin such a program. Does it not say 2010 or later?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, the language is a Minnesota resident student who first enrolled in the fall of 2010 or later, and I'm paraphrasing there, but that's the gist of it. So that's where I'm concerned. You're saying you might be able to implement it starting in 2012 or 2014?
Well, no. If, in fact, the language would mandate that we do this beginning with students matriculating in fall 2010, then, in fact, the CAP would make that very impractical.
Well, Mr. Chair,
meaning the language doesn't work as it is?
It does not.
So I'm happy to have you work on it going forward. I want to be careful that we don't say that we're setting the 4-year tuition rate for these current 2010 enrollees at this low rate, which would be great for them for 4 years, but you can imagine what it's going to look like in 2012 when you got to adjust up to make up for the money that's lost. And then also carry that forward to 4 years, it's going to be a 40 or 50% increase in order to make that work. So someone to be concerned about is happy to work on language or have someone else work on it.
Mr. Zetterberg, can you help us then? We'll get staff too, and Ms. Novak, I believe at a family funeral today, but we'll work with both the Minsky and the university system on that particular problem. And but keep in mind, as I said, you know, with the tuition freezes requested by the governor and using the stimulus money to buy them down and allowing both the university and the Minsky system to increase their tuition at the levels we did, we're going to see a jump out there if things don't get better and we don't find more money. So thank you, Mr. Zetterberg, and thank you for bringing that to our attention, and we will fix it up like in finance or ways and means then, and have that particular issue. I told Representative Distance that this language was in the bill, and he appreciated it, so we'll have to adjust that. Members, I just want to thank all of you. I imagine that this will be our last meeting, and it's been fun, to say the least. And Representative Harness and Anderson, thank you for your leadership and watchdogging of me on that side. And I hope I've been fair. And I want to thank our staff, who I think have done a great job, both our DFL and Republican staffers that are, I think, around here. And yes, they're right back there. And I don't know where I think our pages went to get my members, if I can keep talking, because I think I can pass this vote out of here, but I'm not quite sure here with the numbers. So, oh, here comes one member here. Yeah, let me count here. With that, are there any other folks in the audience that want to say anything on the bill? Are there any other members that want to say anything, Representative Anderson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is being the first time I've ever served with you in a committee setting. It's been an interesting experience and fun.
I take that as a backhanded compliment.
No, it's all good. But I just have to say, it's tough when you're putting together a bill in under the circumstances that we're under. And I understand the challenge that you're facing. But I must say there's a lot of provisions in this bill that give me a lot of concern here. And when I'm talking about, first off, I'm just going to highlight the St. Paul River Center. You've heard me in committee in here and in tax committee that this is the wrong approach for us to be taking, for giving a loan to a city that promised the state that they would pay it back. And here they are, asking for full forgiveness of the entire thing when we have communities throughout the state of Minnesota that fund projects like this on the backs of the local taxpayers. I just think that's wrong. I don't think that it should belong in this bill in the first place, and I just think that's the wrong approach for us to take. I also have some very grave concerns about some of the issues that we have in here as far as some of the money, the workforce development money, and how that's being used. We're putting it towards educational and non-work related training items, and I don't think that that's the intent of the Workforce Development Fund. The Workforce Development Fund is there to retrain workers and get them out into the workforce, not for little educational programs that aren't going to benefit our overall workforce. And I think we're further watering down that important program. I think that's the wrong approach too. I also have concerns in the fact that, you know, we're putting money towards the ice storm damage in Representative Dill's district. Not that it's not a needed, necessary thing to do, but we never heard any testimony on it in committee. We don't even know what exactly it's for, what it's going to do, and I, you know, I'm concerned that we didn't get more details on that at all. So those are just a few of the things that I, you know, wanted to highlight and ask Mr. Chair that we have a roll call vote on this bill, and that hopefully here in the next week or so we'll have a chance to maybe work out some of these differences and come together with a better plan all together.
Well, Representative Anderson, first of all, I haven't served on any committee with you prior to this either, and I have to say it's been an experience and a pleasant one at that. And you know, I hope we can. I hope we don't have to exchange Christmas presents. But if we do, I'm going to get you a real nice present. I will promise that. Made in USA, and, you know, but to your first concern about the St. Paul project, you know, what I tried to do in this bill is talk about jobs that we could put on the ground right away, and that's one that can get moving right away, and we heard the testimony on that. You heard Mayor Coleman, it's one of the few arenas that didn't get any money, and I agree with you, and I did say many years ago that St. Paul would probably not pay the full amount, but they have paid for, I believe, 11 years, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, out of a $170 million piece of the building, we will pay all but about $30 million of it.
Yeah, but and that other arena is needed for the Wild and for the communities, and it can get going right away, and it doesn't, the payments last for four more years. And regarding the, I think this is a really good bill, but regarding the ice storm, I tried to be very fair to Representative Detmer, and last night I was even fairer to him. And the ice storm just happened. In fact, Representative Detmer and I talked about this last night because he's got a house in Silver Bay, and it happened 2 weeks ago, and it devastated 12 full townships up there in Lake County, right above the lake and above the ridge system that runs there. Leveled the entire aspen, mostly aspen, but other trees, and they had asked for about $570,000. I had a letter from the commissioner. It just happened, so there was no time to get a bill in. And I found some money that he had promised, if I'm not mistaken, had promised Representative Detmer that they would find the money, and they didn't. And that's a Republican-controlled agency, but I did. So I tried to be really fair about it. I did a lot of initiatives for Republicans, for Representative Seifert, Inventors Congress, for former Representative Fences to keep that rural policy initiative going. And regarding the Workforce Development Fund, Mr. Berg helped me out, but I don't think we did anything different than what was done in other years other than a couple of programs. Representative Clark program, a small program for Native Americans, and I think the trial program on the presentation we had on the bill from Representative Hayden's. So that's about the only thing new in there. And I did not restore all the cuts that the governor had made with those dollars. So with that, members, I'd appreciate your support. And if there's nothing further to come in front of the committee, I again want to thank our staff, Laura, and your staff, Mike, and
our two pages, Jeff and Andy, for all their help, and thank all of you for your indulgence and input. And with that, then the roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll, and I'll vote yes.
Anderson, no. Atkins.
Why? He votes yes.
Yes.
Greiner.
Yes.
Clark.
Yes.
Detmer.
No.
Downey.
No.
Eastman.
No.
Gunther. Todd.
Yes.
Mahoney.
Yes.
McFarland.
Yes.
Murphy.
Yes.
Norna.
No.
Norton.
Yes.
Obermuller.
Yes.
Poppy.
Aye.
Reiner.
Yes.
Slocum.
Yes.
Welke.
Yes.
There being 14 yes and 5 nays, the bill is passed and re-referred to the Finance Committee. Thank all of you, and we'll see all of you later. Meeting is adjourned.